Okay, so I didn't get a huge amount of warning that I was going to be giving a research talk today, so I've ended up with something slightly different to what might otherwise have presented. And one of the things I thought I would just do is talk about some of the work that that I do on numerical computational methods. And I'm going to talk a little, and I'm going to try and make a connection, I think, a little bit between what I do in methodology and some of the things that have been, that I've seen in tutorials and the teaching lectures, if you like. And that is to actually think about, so you see all these nice rheological diagrams and the rheology of this or that other material depends on the following things, and there's a very long list. And we look at that list and go, oh great, okay, now we understand everything. So how do you take that information and start developing computational methods that are kind of appropriate to that? Because they're not exactly simple things. So to recap, I guess this is sort of another image from the paper from 1998, which was about the transition from stagnant lid convection to mobile lid convection, using this sort of one additional rheological parameter over what people had done before, which was to introduce a yield stress and to say that at some point the strength of the material becomes can no longer sustain higher stresses. Okay, and you see a transition in behavior, and we spent a whole lot of time running lots of different models, and we thought we understood what was going on. And since then, a lot more calculations were done. A year or two later was a calculation saying, well, you get a more interesting surface behavior if you also include this or that other effect. In this case, that there should be some asthenospheric layer that, you can see the green line has more plate-like behavior than the red line, or the dotted lines. Certainly more plate-like behavior than the blue dotted line. So the introduction of these various things sort of goes along, and one of the other ingredients that is really important, that came up this morning, was, well, why are some places strong and other places appear to be weak? The plate boundaries in particular appear to be weak, but the rest of the plate is quite strong. Well, one of the things that is actually quite typical about materials that have these kind of yielding behaviors is that they localize, that one part of the system becomes very weak, and by becoming weak, the rest of the system is de-stressed and can heal and is no longer weak and remains strong, right? It's a very, very, very typical behavior. So this is a very old calculation, and I'm showing the old stuff deliberately, actually, because it's sort of showing you how long we've known all of these things and how hard they can be to sort of just become relatively simple, well-understood models. Okay, so this is a case where we have exactly that behavior, that once you start to deform the material and it starts to yield, then it just becomes weaker and weaker. It's a runaway. Right? And that's not the only sort of effect, but we need those kinds of behaviors in order to model more sophisticated things. And here is sort of an example of the kinds of models that those developed into. And so these are relatively more recent. And this is showing just a sort of a thin layer to visualize the thin layer is sort of sprinkled on top of a lithosphere in which there is a subducting material, and a collider comes in, and you can see there's buckling and folding and all sorts of interesting things that we know should happen for materials that have strong contrast in rheology, but also ones in which the rheology tends to have these interesting yielding type behaviors. All right, so these are sort of obviously outcomes of models, and they include certain things about the rheology in those models, but how do we look at that? And how do we kind of take what we know about the very shallow behavior of materials, and sort of brittle-like behavior, or at least localizing behavior of materials they'd well understood how to model all this sort of stuff in the engineering literature, which is obviously from much, much lower pressures. But also, the engineering literature tends to look at something like failure as a failure, right? They go, oh, this material is no longer intact, therefore the structure that we created is no longer intact, right? So the building fell down. That's a bad thing. And so a lot of the engineering work that we would rely on to develop an understanding of the material behavior sort of stops at the point where for geology it gets interesting, right? So we're interested in the false form, and then they do stuff. But this is not sort of as common in the engineering literature to look at the system and just keep going after it's failed. Of course, you know, metal deforming. There are things, of course, where people are really interested in how this goes. So this is another sort of model. It's just of taking a material that has a sort of a frictional behavior, which I'll get to later, and just looking at how the deformation localizes. So the strain rate is up above. So you can see that the applying a shear boundary conditions to this, and the total plastic strain, the strain that occurs after failure, is in the kind of reddish colors below on the second one down. Right? So they correspond to one another, but you can see there has been more deformation. There's more complicated deformation early than there is later. And so how do we kind of combine that view of very large deformation and this kind of rheology? Well, I'm going to just go through, it turns into a bit of a tutorial, but because I'd sort of thought about this, and so maybe it does connect some of the things that we looked at. So we have equations of motion, which are actually exactly the ones that were shown for, well, I'm thinking here in terms of a viscous flow. So these you could interpret these as being the same things that we looked at in the convection problem. The gradient of stresses, pressure gradients, balanced by some sort of buoyancy forces. There's a little extra term on the right there, which is represents something else, which I'll get to in a minute. We can assume incompressibility. That's sort of a very hard constraint, so we can put it in. And we would like to be able to solve that problem, right? So that's sort of how you've seen that problem written out already, or at least some version of that. And the similar version for the thermal evolution of the problem, again with these sort of funny index notations. So mine's very similar notation to stuff that was used earlier, but these funny little commas mean differentiate with respect to me. So it's very compact, but if you haven't seen that before, then it's a bit annoying, sorry. And then there's this idea of the constitutive behavior, right? The rheology, the way the material responds. You know, the relationship in this case between the stress and the strain rate. Okay, so in a viscous fluid, it's a relation between stress and strain rate, so you should interpret those used there as being velocities. And this looks a bit more complicated than we saw previously, because I tried to put a whole bunch of things in. And those things that I put in are the things that sort of come up all the time in the discussions of rheology. Viscoelasticity is the first term. So that's a rate of change of stress divided by some modulus that you can get, right? So the rate of change of stress is related to the strain rate. So those two rates go together. The viscosity, the viscous response, so the stress and strain rate are related to one another. And this one is a plasticity term, okay? And I've written it here as an anisotropic term, and I'll show you why in a minute. And that's not as general as you can get, but it actually is quite useful to see all those terms written down, because they're probably it's not very enjoyable to sort of see those and have to think about what everything is. But the assumption is that you can add these different deformation processes together, and your total strain rate is sort of how much does it deform by viscous means, how much by elastic means, how much by plasticity. And one or the other will be dominant at any given time, and you can make choices really about what those things should, you know, how those things should switch on, switch off. Right, that term for viscoelasticity turns out to be pretty complicated and also annoying, right? And what does it represent? Well, it's quite interesting what it represents, actually, because I told you it was the rate of change of the stress, but there's some important little caveats that go with that. Yes, it is the rate of change of the stress, but it's written in a certain way. So I've written it here as a sort of a rate of change with time plus, and that's supposed to be rate of change with time in a given spot, plus these additional terms. Okay, now Bruce mentioned that there were additional terms that we added when we deal with the thermal problem to account for advection. So as a parcel of material moves, so it carries with it its thermal history. And in the viscoelastic case, you have exactly the same thing, and that green box surrounds the bit that looks like that. So as the parcel moves, it carries its history of stress with it. All right. What's the next term? The next term is about the fact that actually the stresses may rotate. Okay, so this is now not a scalar. It's a tensor quantity. And so you can imagine if you bent a stick and then walk over here and let go, that's fine, right? Just does that, bends back again the same way. But if I actually just tip over and let go, I have to account for the rotation as well. Okay, so this term is sort of just required to keep the equations objective, so that it doesn't change when you change your point of view. All right. And if you in the literature is full of arguments about whether this is important or not. And then there are additional terms that are associated with some shearing that may occur as you pass along the path of a parcel of material. And those shearing terms are interesting. They are more constitutive. You actually need to know something. You need to look at the individual material and see what it does in order to understand whether this term is important or not. This one should be to do with basic physics, right? It shouldn't, you know, it needs to be invariant in a Galilean invariance or something, right? So that one you can't really sort of get away from. Whether it's important or not is another matter, but the last one is constitutive. But one way you can think about this is sort of how I described it, that we're always worried, and those terms are pretty ugly, right? So I don't know if anyone was really actually paying attention enough to look and try and ask me what it means, but the W is the rotation tensor for the point at which you're looking. The D here is the strain rate tensor, and you have to get a little bit creative with your nomenclature when you've got all these different, you're trying to keep the elastic people happy and the viscous people happy. So those terms are actually quite complicated, and if you try to evaluate them numerically, they're horrible. They're really horrible. So sometimes it's helpful to take a step back and go, all right, well, that's very complicated. So this is where my contribution to this whole thing comes in, I think. I looked at that previous set of equations, and that's really complicated, and I don't know what's going on, and I don't really know how to implement that into a mantle convection code. Okay. But what I do understand how to do is the following. Well, what is that derivative really mean? Well, you can look at it and think of it as a limit. Okay, it's a limit as you let the time step go to a very small number of the difference in the stress tensor from one time to another. Okay, now how do we get all those extra terms about the rotations and everything? Well, because during the time we go from the first time we measure stress to the second time we measure the stress, the point we're interested in, or the parcel of fluid we're interested in, has moved along some complicated path. It probably has rotated during that movement, and it may even have sheared, right? So there are two ways to worry about that term. One is to expand it mathematically, which was what was in the previous thing. The other thing is to say, well, What about a numerical approach that would look like that, rather than implementing all of the other things? Okay. All right. So I'll just see where I'm going with this. There's a lot of equations, and I just wrote them down lots of times to keep coming back. So we've got a momentum conservation. We've got constitutive equation, which is quite general, but has terms in it that are potentially quite nasty. Right. So we just had a look at the viscoelastic one, and I left you with a sort of a thought bubble, which is, wouldn't it be nice if there was a numerical way of doing that that was so natural? And then there's this plasticity term, which, who knows what that is? Okay. Oh, well, let's not. So the equations of motion. Did that help? No. Doesn't matter. Okay. The point is that. Your equation of motion, what you do is you substitute the rheology terms back into the equation of motion. You get something that looks like that, which is quite complicated, again. but actually, contains terms that are exactly the same as the ones for standard viscous mantle convection, plus some corrections. All right? So this opens up the possibility to say, okay, we can take a mantle convection code and we can slot pieces into all the right places, and then we will have a viscoelastic plastic convection code. That means we can do the lithosphere and we can do the mantle all at once. Okay? So typically, I started with this business about the yield stress. And I'll just carry on and sort of finish it off, right? So the idea of the yield stress, which forms the part of this plasticity kind of term in an engineering sense of modeling plasticity, you start off with this idea that at some point your stress gets larger than the material would support, and or your predicted stress, you should call it, right? The stress you predict you're going to get out of your convection simulation or your buckling simulation is larger than the material can support. So in fact, it needs to be reduced. And we do that by saying, well, we can switch from the simple rheology to something a little bit more complicated. All right? The classical way to do that is to take the viscosity and to reduce it a bit until the stress is matched by the stress falls back to the value that you've set as a limiter. Okay? But you realize that if you do that, all you can do is reduce the magnitude of the stress, right? Because you're changing the viscosity, and your strain rate is the same, so you don't change the pattern of deformation immediately by doing that. So you can only satisfy the fact that something like the stress invariant is reduced. There's a simulation on that one, I didn't realize. And that classically looks something like this, where you add some correction to the viscosity, and it follows the same strain rate. All right. So this means that, in fact, you're just changing the scalar value of the stress. But typically, or let me sort of explain this. That's not really how we think about the way that stresses are released in the Earth. Right. Normally, we might form a fault. And if you form a fault, you have a relationship between the shear stress and the normal stress. That is, they change with respect to one another, right? We put a limit on one as a ratio of the other. So you can't really change that. In general, it's not possible to change that arbitrarily, that ratio, by just changing the overall magnitude of the stress. I mean, that's not quite true, but it's generally you can't change the magnitude of the shear stress and change the ratio of all of its components, right? You can't just scale it up and down and change the ratios. That means that we change one component of the stress differently to the others. We want to say the shear stress to be bounded, then we have to have some relationship which is no longer isotropic, and that's why I put in this anisotropic thing. I think it's a bit ugly. But it's actually quite general, because you can then start to say, well, there are many of these relationships out there, and with this kind of approach, with a little bit of foresight, you can sort of generalize this to different kinds of rheology. All right, so we can have a scalar version of this, or we can have a tensor version of that. Okay, so now we've got a list of things that we're interested in, and I'll just wrap up by showing you how that maps to numerical approaches, right? So you should be familiar with this by now, right? There is the typical convection problem. It forms complicated boundary layers. And the major assumption when you do analysis is that the strain is basically infinite. And we know there are little places where things don't always get mixed, et cetera, but basically the assumption of strains being enormously high, so much that we don't even think about them, right? One parcel is equivalent to another. And in the lithosphere, not the case, right? Here's a model in which it forms shear bands. The material in here is very different from the material there because it has already yielded. How do we do those two things together? All right, well, so this is what we've been working on for quite some time, and it's very similar to the particle and cell methods. When I first presented this, Dave Ewan was in the audience. Some of you will know Dave Ewan. He's not renowned for his polite discourse, and he pointed out to me, and not exactly, I'll paraphrase, right, pointed out to me that we don't use this method anymore. It was used in 1962, and then we gave up because it's so... I'll delete the rest of it, right? It's not very accurate. but it turns out that these methods have made a comeback. They've made a comeback in the context of finite elements, and the underworld code that we've been producing for a while is based on this method. I think Aspect has the same approach now, or at least can do, and the code of Taras Gerria, for example. And the approach is really quite straightforward, and that is that you have a Lagrangian reference frame which allows you to particles that track the fluid to allow you to do tracking of composition, or of that stress history, or of the plasticity history, okay? Those things flux around, and because they move, you can track their translation, you can track their rotation, you can track their local sense of shear, and therefore all of those complicated terms that are in the equations, if you really try to do this on a grid, all just vanish and are replaced by essentially ordinary differential equations of one kind or another, where you're just integrating through time on what happens to an individual parcel. So much more close to what the physical process is that you're trying to understand. But at the same time, we retain the idea of the cells, the mesh that we use to do the computations, and that means we can keep all of our machinery for the classic fluid dynamics problem. That's really important because as there is no time scale in the Stokes problem, as Bruce pointed out, information passes around the whole system instantaneously. And so you need some very efficient and very structured methods to pass that information around quickly to solve them. Okay. And so that's really was my point, right? So when you see a model like this, these particles are actually part of something. They are really telling you something about what we're calculating and where. Okay, and we spend a lot of effort trying to work out slightly better numerical techniques for mapping the rheology and so forth. But the real part that for us has been, you know, so useful is being able to take the complicated stuff and make it relatively simple, and then becomes a computer science problem instead of a real science problem, I can say. And a couple of examples. So we've recently published a paper looking at the formation of cratonic lithosphere, and that's another problem where you have strength gradients, you have history gradients history differences that you want to track, and you have, in this case, we have extremely high Rayleigh number, but we also have yielding. All right, so we want to be able to track all of those things simultaneously. I think that would be a movie, but I'm sort of out of time for that. And in a sense, what we're doing is we're moving towards being able to simulate stuff. And I just show this. This is the work of Dan Sandiford, who started this work actually in this room 2 years ago as part of the whole sort of subduction project, trying to get his underworld models to reproduce everybody else's work. And what's come out of that is the idea that actually you're starting to be able to put enough information in by extending this concept of the particles representing stuff to be able to really just take a situation and model it. And anyone who's looked at Taras Gerrier's group, well, the work that they're doing, will see the same sort of thing, that the ability to take a particular place and reproduce the geometry has really taken a step forward. And in many ways, as a result of these kinds of views of the numerical problem. Okay.
So what has made the difference in terms of bringing these particles back?
You could repeat the question. Yeah. So why, in other words, why are these methods making a comeback, and how did we get past some of the things that were a problem in 1962 or whenever they gave up using them first time? So I have to admit the problems remain, but one of the things that was always an issue is that you have the problem represented twice. So you have an Eulerian formulation, the background mesh of the problem, which is very efficient, very lightweight, and then you have all of these particles that represent everything else, you know, potentially billions of the things. So one of the things that's helped is that memory is really no longer an issue in computation, right? So the rate at which memory has become more available has gone up faster than the rate of sort of CPU, right? So we can throw particles at the problem. That's not really an issue. The other one is a little bit more mathematical and fundamental, which is that when you have two representations of the problem, keeping them synchronized is not always straightforward. And there is sort of a null space issue that you have far more particles than you have degrees of freedom in the mesh, and therefore multiple distributions of the particles can, in principle, produce the same flow pattern. I mean, we know that anyway, right? Because some of these things don't act on everything. But it's especially complicated when those are rheological. Some of that has sort of gone away by actually sort of understanding the problem better. If you do this in a finite element context, there is sort of a unique mapping that you can develop, and that actually really does help. Every particle contributes in some way. And so I think it's really that in a sense is there. There's still these problems. This is never going to end, right? We can still go forward, but I think the issue doesn't lend itself to fully Lagrangian modeling either, because this may also change. But the efficient solvers that work, they just work so much better on structured and hierarchical grids.
When you perform the collision, do you need to perform like four mesh deformation?
Do we need to perform a mesh deformation?
Yeah.
So that's one of the advantages, is that your mesh geometry and your Lagrangian geometry can be decoupled, and it can be arbitrarily decoupled. So you can move the mesh if it's convenient to do so, but you don't have to. And so you track geometrical evolution by the particle the particle deformation field. But so an example where it's helpful to deform is a classic buckling experiment. So if you try and do a benchmark in which you recreate the well-known analytic solutions of a buckling beam, right, a viscous or viscoelastic beam, it has well-known wavelengths at which it buckles, and those things are hard to get if you just have particles, because the unperturbed field is almost doesn't see it, and so a small perturbation to the mesh to get it going is almost is a really useful way of doing this, and then you can allow it to deform.
So this is probably a follow-up to Bruce's question. I always thought that one of the problems of the material point method or the particle and cell method is that it's also hard to quantify the error that we actually make when solving the equations. So for finite element methods, we have relatively well-established theories for how big the error is for our solution, while with marker methods, we kind of have just a general understanding that more markers are better, but...
I think, so Dave May, who was a student who worked on a lot of this, he had some convergence proofs. And he showed some, I mean, they weren't very encouraging, but we learned something about the relationship between the mapping you use to essentially fit the, effectively whether these are sort of just point functions or whether they represent a surface or something like that. So if you were to fit a surface of a known polynomial order, then you can make some proofs about the convergence rate and what you need. We don't generally do a lot of that because I think there's a lot of other things that are problematic. You can also just do a sort of, we have analytic solutions and we can distribute particles in interesting ways through them and learn what the error is. And so you can look at that in a sort of, sort of stochastic way, if you like.
So can you say a few more words about the difference between the particle in-cell method and, say, the ratio method that's used in, say, sitcom?
The what method?
The tracer method, the ratio method?
Yeah, so what you're trying to do is, what you're doing in those cases, so the tracer ratio method is about, it addresses exactly this issue, right? How do you map from a big collection of particles to obtain the most sensible buoyancy term or viscosity term for that individual region of your mesh? And there are multiple choices you can make. So the material point method is very specific about what it does. You recreate a different integration, you integrate them all. Okay, and you replace the standard finite element machinery with a different piece of machinery. And the trace ratio method is another way to do that. So in principle, both of those questions are related, right? So in some sense, there is an accuracy that is, we know that neither of those is exactly the right way to do it, and what you're trying to obtain is a convergent method that if you add more particles or you refine the mesh, you get a better solution. And you won't guarantee that those convergence rates are always the same. They may be problem dependent, and I think the important thing is for people to be aware that there are multiple ways to do any of these problems that you need to understand. There's a whole lot of stuff going on in the background before you do it.
Are these also the integration points or not?
I shouldn't show this one, right? Because this one is in here they are. Everything, but I'm not necessarily visualizing all the particles, right? I mean, here there's a temperature field, and I'm just visualizing that as a interpolated field.
So, I have a question that is likely to maybe get some laughs. But okay, so in the visualization that you showed, it looks like in some regions the particles get concentrated, and the other regions they get kind of diluted. And so I know you don't show all of them, but do you, like, does the accuracy then go down in regions that experience some kind of, like, divergence where the particles move away? And do you, like, create new particles in voids and delete particles where there's a bunch of them?
Yes.
To all?
So everything you said.
Yay! Yes. Okay.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, so we do have to have, it's a Lagrangian method, so you have to have some equivalent of remeshing because you're the Lagrangian part will, all of these issues that are associated with the mixing problem are associated with this, where you've got a stagnation point, you tend to sift particles away. And so we do have to repopulate them. And it's a remeshing step. But the good thing about it is that you don't do it all at once. You do it in places where it's required. And if you do it incrementally, we've tried different strategies, but you can basically record local strain, and then you know which particles to split and in which directions and that kind of thing. So there's approaches to this which are kind of reasonable, that just like any other numerical
Thank you.